Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It's Christmas! It's Christmas! It's Christmas Day! Oh my God! I didn't think it was gonna come this year! He's been! It's Christmas! He's been! It's gonna be 2 hours of this. He's been! It's Christmas! Happy Christmas! Merry Christmas, Nathaniel!
You boy! What day is it?
Oh, you, Governor! It's December the 25th. It's Christmas Day. Mr. Scrooge.
How festive is this? This is the most Christmas.
Oh, you didn't
Christmas.
Know it. You didn't. I thought we were going to do a.
Oh, we keep doing Scrooge. Or he doesn't say something like, "Oh, I'm happy from my head to my garters or something." He starts going off a bit at that point, doesn't he? Oh, is it? Whoa! He does all that.
Is it wrong to say that I preferred Scrooge when he was a bit of a cunt?
I guess he certainly could be quite annoying, couldn't he, as the jolly Scrooge?
Yeah, absolutely. He's certainly more interesting. But also, you know, when he's jolly, do you know, how long's that going to really last?
Yeah, well, he's jolly for the rest of the time, because people say that no one kept Christmas as well as Mr. Scrooge did from that day on.
Yeah, I think that's bollocks. But also, how many good years did he have left in him anyway?
You can never tell in those... in Victorian times, you can never really tell how old someone is, can you? Like, it's like, you can't work out how old he's meant to be. Is he meant to be...
Well, in the book, I know he's like always like he's very old and withered and like hunched over and kind of
yes,
craggy.
He is hunched over. Yes,
because it was written back in Charles Dickens' days. He was 28 in the book all the way through.
What's interesting about the book is all the way through the book they refer to Scrooge's nephew as Scrooge's nephew. Then at the end, they just say he's called Fred. And you go, why don't you just call him Fred all the way through then? He's been going, then Scrooge's nephew said this, and then Scrooge's nephew said that. At the end, they just call him Fred. But there doesn't seem to be a significance in the name Fred that they would hold that back.
Well, maybe not in that book, but there certainly is a little bit of significance in the movie Fred Claus.
Of course, maybe that's what they were thinking of.
Maybe that's not what Charles Dickens was thinking of. Maybe he didn't think that in 100 years' time they'll make a Vince Vaughn comedy where he plays Santa's less famous brother Fred. But maybe there's more to Fred Claus than first meets
the eye. I do like A Christmas Carol, though. It's one of my...
Which is your favourite?
I think
mine is Ding Dong Merrily on High. It's going to be stuff like this for about 2 hours, guys. This is our Christmas special. You're listening to Fan Club.
What do you think of the cow, the holly and the ivy? I really like it, but it's a proper dirge, isn't it?
The holly and ivy?
Yeah.
I think that's one of the examples where someone sat down with sort of like a spider diagram thinking, what are the things that are about... Yeah, what are the things about Christmas? And they've gone holly and ivy, and then they've started the song, and they've gone, I've got a tune, but I'm really struggling with the lyrics. And then the deadline approached, and it was like, okay, it's literally going to be about a couple of twigs.
They've barely got a tune, to be fair. It's a proper, like...
We're going to talk about the holly and the ivy. If you're at home, join in.
When they are both full grown of all the... Summings the
four calling birds, three French.
That's the one. We got it right.
My name's Nick. This is
Daniel Metcalf.
There's always a delay there. Is that because do you respond immediately when I say this is?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not having a delay.
Maybe
unless it's like something, I'm not actually that, but maybe it takes a while for the message to get to my brain. But I wonder if it's a Zoom thing where there's like half a second.
I wonder how much of our lives this year has been kind of like delayed by Zoom. Worth thinking about.
Christmas!
It's Christmas, it's Christmas. So you're joining us on our special Christmas Day fan club.
Christmas Day special. We're like horses on FUBAR.
We are. This will be the tradition. We're like Morecambe and Wise. We're both wise. We're two wise men, and we're on our way. Have you put on your Christmas jumper?
Yeah, I've got one.
Do you know what I was about to say? It's a bit warm for a jumper, but that's because I'm in my flat.
I think it will be, but I'll get festive.
But I've got my radiators on because it's Christmas Day. Why not? Why not push the bloody boat out? I can hear the pots and pans clattering around in the next room, which is worrying because I live alone. I can hear the sound of children playing and people celebrating and having a nice time because the walls in my flat are very thin, and I'm going to have to write a note. I think an anonymous note, post it through the letterbox and say, "Keep it down. Some of us are trying to concentrate." So, first rule of fan club is tell your friends about fan club. Yes. I don't think we did that last week.
No, I don't.
And the second rule of fan club is please, for the love, tell your friends. But you know what? There's no need to tell your friends today. Today is
a day off
for you. Have a day off from telling your friends.
But tomorrow, start all the more early. He says to me.
You see, I've got this little red mark on my face.
Can't see it. It's very faint.
You can see that red mark. I'm pointing right at it.
Can't see it.
I can see it on my camera. Why can't you see it on your camera? You can see it. It's a red mark on my face. Maybe a little bit. Just say if you can see it or not. You're not going to hurt my feelings.
I can't see it.
There's a red mark right here. Look at that. Look, all of my skin is the exact right same colour, and then I've got that bit right there. I've got that red mark there. Do you know what that is?
What is it?
That is a third degree burn from bubbling soup. It came out, spat right in my face, and burnt my face.
This last night?
This was after. This is on Christmas Eve. It happened.
Yes, on Christmas Eve. December 20th.
Or whenever you're listening. They begged us not to do this episode, didn't they? They said, please, don't do one on Christmas.
That's the campaign. We've campaigned
for this for
you.
And they said, you're only allowed to do a Christmas one if you've got a really good guest. But we haggled them down. So, we were talking about Christmas Carol. What's your favourite version of Christmas Carol, you said?
Oh, yeah. I think I like Alistair Sim, and I was going to say, what's your favourite one?
But the thing about Christmas Carol is, it's like, isn't it like there's Dracula and there's like the Three Musketeers? But I don't think Three Musketeers has been done in a while, and Dracula's done like every so often. But it's like, it feels to me like the Christmas Carol is the most retold story in pop culture history.
I've never read the book till a couple of years ago.
And you've read the book?
I've read the book, and it's great. And I had that thing where I went, do you know what? This Dickens, he's pretty on it, isn't he? He's good. It's really fun.
Is it a long read?
No, not at all. Not at all. Hours it would take you.
Right. So it's quite long.
And what they say, which is true, is that the Muppet one is probably the most faithful accurate to the book. Yeah, and it's great. It's really funny, and it's really sort of smart, and it kind of tells you what the characters are thinking as well. And the narrator also appears to be a ghost in it, which is quite nice. So, which I think might be quite spooky when you're reading it.
Well, so it is a ghost story, though, isn't it? It's a Christmas ghost story. Are there any changes? I mean, how are the other versions of Christmas Carol less accurate? It's just, you just know how it's going to end, don't you?
Yeah, but it is more about, the Muppet one is more accurate in that it's more about a kind of redemption and a return to the man he was. And it's more about the idea that, you know, it's got that weird thing where he obviously resents his nephew because his sister died and he loves his sister. And it's more that it's painful. So it's this thing that he's kind of, he's miserable because essentially he's had quite a tough life as well. It's not
that's
that
not in Muppets, though. That's not in the Muppets, though, is it?
Well, you get more of the backstory, don't you? I feel like in the other versions, you only get the kind of his rise, don't you? It seems to be like his rise from being a little bit kind of, but almost as soon as he gets the option to make some money, he goes, "Yeah, I'll have some money." But I feel,
I suppose when you see Alistair Sim, you think, "Well, this guy was always a cunt," you know. and so when he redeems himself, it's sort of like a little bit like, oh, there was some good in him, right? But really, A Christmas Carol is the Darth Vader story where he started off good, he lost his way, and then he gets redeemed by, you know, the ghost of Ben Kenobi.
Yeah.
And Yoda, and then eventually the ghost of himself at the end, as he watches his own body get burnt on the forest moon of Endor. And I think that in a way, the Star Wars trilogy... Well, the Star Wars trilogy is very much kind of like the story of Darth Vader, isn't it? It's kind of... the Star Wars trilogy, the Star Wars franchise is very much the story of A Christmas Carol, where you have Darth Vader as he is in the original trilogy, and he gets, over the course of that, he gets redeemed. And he gets visited by three ghosts, and that is the ghosts of the prequels, where you go back and see what he was like as a lad. And then the ghosts of Christmas Future, which is fucking dreadful. So then it's all about him, like, going, "Oh, fucking hell, I better accept love into my heart and be a good dad to Luke. And by the way, tell Leia I'm sorry, and now I'm dead." And that's basically A Christmas Carol in a nutshell. So that's one more mark against the Star Wars franchise for unoriginality. It gets worse by the second. So who else was there? There was George C. Scott. He was one.
Yeah, I've never seen that. Have you seen that?
No. There was who was the other one? It was the
Albert
British
Finney
guy
in the musical.
Albert Finney did it in the musical, right? Okay. I want to say who was? It was not Victor Meldrew that did it.
Richard Wilson.
Richard Wilson, he hasn't done one.
Yeah, I don't know. It feels like in the 90s, I'm surprised they didn't do a BBC version with Richard Wilson.
Well, yeah, but like, so outside of actually telling the story, you've got it kind of like, I really like Mickey's Christmas Carol, which I always found goofy with the sort of like bandage around his face, kind of like quite creepy.
Is that Scrooge McDuck as Scrooge?
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, it would be. I think it's one of like the first appearances of Scrooge McDuck as well. Maybe he was a cartoon strip and then they kind of used him. But, like, his name is Scrooge, isn't it? Yeah, so his name is actually Scrooge. So maybe he was created for Mickey's Christmas Carol. And Mickey plays, like, Bob Cratchit. And I do actually think that Muppet's Christmas Carol is kind of, like, the best version of it. I don't really like Scrooged. I like a kind of...
Like Scrooged. I know people that really don't like it. I think it's great. I'm kind of interested why people don't like it.
What's interesting about Scrooge was when it came out, like, Bill Murray had basically gone into self-imposed retirement and he was like, and he didn't really want to do it, but they kind of, then he thought, oh, maybe I can work with these kind of writers and I can come up with something interesting. And then Richard Donner came in to direct it. Richard Donner was a bit worried about directing it, but then he got on really well with Bill Murray when they met. And then they fell out when they made it, and then Bill Murray hated it. And he hated the whole process. And then everyone kind of like was just like, oh, right, this is a shit show. And when they actually marketed it, weirdly, like, it never occurred to me, but when they marketed it, they said, Bill Murray is getting visited by some more ghosts this year. And they basically marketed it all around. It's Bill Murray, it's ghosts, it's Ghostbusters, it's Ghostbusters meets Christmas, it's Scrooged. I think there's some sort of like RoboCop-esque like satire in there, where they're kind of like talking about like how cynical TV companies and advertising is at Christmas time. And yeah, I like it. And Karen Allen's in it; she's really good. But apparently they spent ages and ages on the script.
It's basically the first Bill Murray film, isn't it? Since Ghostbusters, he pops up in Little Shop of Horrors, but there's no other Bill Murray films in between.
Yeah, he sort of, which I think it's kind of like, it was really weird because he started making more films in the 90s.
Yeah.
And you were kind of like going, why aren't these Bill Murray films very good? And it's because, you know, he did like Larger Than Life, Osmosis Jones. He wasn't in it much, but he was in it. He popped up in Space Jam. He directed Quick Change in 1990. What was the other one? The Man Who Knew Too Little.
Mm-hmm. What about Bob,
which is... some people's favourite film of all time.
What's the Farrelly Brothers one? Woody Harrelson.
Oh, Kingpin. He came in as sort of like a... and he is great in that, but that film is so tonally inconsistent that it's... Because at some points it plays like a really broad spoof, and at some points it plays like quite a hard-hitting drama about an alcoholic that's lost his career. At one point... they cut his hand off in a bowling ball machine, and it plays as like pure horror. It's just absolutely just sickening and terrifying. And they zoom in on Woody Harrell's face as he's screaming as he's getting his hand removed. And then the next scene is kind of like Randy Quaid taking a dump in a urinal because he's never seen one before. And it's kind of like, it's just so all over the place. Isn't it?
Oh, there we go.
Am I back?
You're back. He cut out for a second.
What did you... it's all good. But the film is just so all over the place. And then you've got Bill Murray, and it's kind of like almost a career-best performance in it, where it's everything you kind of love about Bill Murray... poured into this bad guy, supervillain kind of character.
The other one, I guess, is from around that time, is Ed Wood, where he's just like a supporting character.
Yeah. But like, I think the 80s, I think because maybe he did Stripes, Ghostbusters, and then he was around, like you said, in Little Shop of Horrors. And then what was that? Apparently, he's got a cameo as himself in She's Having a Baby.
Which is She's Having a Baby?
It's Kevin Bacon, it's John Hughes, and I'm in a WhatsApp group where there was a question which was, name the Kevin Bacon movie which features cameos from both John Candy and Bill Murray. And
Maybe I've never seen it.
I don't think I've ever seen it. My first guess was He Said, She Said, and they said no, and then I said, well, She's Having a Baby then, and it was. And so I was right. Makes sense that it's John Hughes because he loved John Candy. Just opening a Pepsi Max cherry, guys. It's Christmas Day. Why not? I don't know. What else is there? I mean, like, okay, so how many versions? Mad Dog and Glory and Wild Things. He's great in Wild Things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Wild Things is one of them really sleazy kind of 90s erotic kind of thrillers. And... And it could be absolute disposable trash. And then that's got Kevin Bacon. Kevin Bacon produced it. And I think because they wanted female nudity in it, Kevin Bacon agreed to go full frontal in it as well. So that, you know, to even things up a bit. And it's got Matt Dillon in it. I think Wild Things was quite big at the time, but it's sort of like a forgotten gem where it's just this absolute piece of sleazy... It's set in kind of Florida. It's really hot. There's like alligators in it, like swimming around and stuff. And then you've got Bill Murray pops up as this kind of crooked lawyer. And you're kind of like trying to work out what sort of film it is. And then Bill Murray turns up and you go, oh, it's just meant to be entertaining. And then it's just this really entertaining piece of sleazy filth. It's brilliant.
Charlie's Angels. What's that, 98 or something?
I think that was 2000.
Oh, was it as late as that? Okay, maybe it is a slightly different era. I guess now, yeah, we're crossing over into when he has his sort of indie comeback now, aren't we?
Charlie's Angels was also starred Luke Wilson. And so Luke Wilson was obviously part of Bottle Rocket and all of that lot. And Tenenbaums and Wes Anderson, and then that must be what kind of, like... I don't know, but there must be kind of small circles, I imagine. And Drew Barrymore and Owen Wilson had made Home Fries together. And wasn't Luke Wilson in Never Been Kissed at some point?
Right, yeah. And it was a Drew Barrymore project, wasn't it? The Charlie's Angels, it's fully, like...
Yeah, she produced it. Bill Murray was such a cunt on set that basically he wasn't invited back for the sequel. So he got replaced by
Bernie Mac
playing his brother, which is hilarious. and I say the word hilarious with a small H. It was, yeah. So, but I don't know. Bill Murray and Lucy Liu didn't get on with each other on the set. And I think if you're going to get rid of someone, it's not going to be one of the main cast. I'm sure he hasn't sort of had any sleepless nights about it.
No. Doesn't he famously have like a... is it an answer machine he has rather than an agent? So you never really know whether he'll do your film. You just have to leave a message.
I think he's got a landline. He's got an answer phone to a landline in it. But, like, I mean, anyway. But Bill Murray's like this legendary comedian, but when you actually sum up all of the stuff that he did, he wasn't the lead in that many films in the 80s. And then when he was the lead in a lot of comedies in the 90s, they were largely kind of like, oh, God, why have you done this? Larger Than Life was with The Elephant. Oh, fuck me. It's kind of... And then when he did Rushmore, that was kind of like, oh, yeah, this is the exact sort of stuff you should be doing.
It's nice. But anyway. He's good. He's pretty much good in most... That's not true. He's good. he's often good. And he can do it. And I think sometimes he needs to remind audiences that when he comes back, he goes, oh, yeah, I forgot. We love Bill Murray. Oh, I've also remembered Groundhog Day. That's the other big one he did.
Oh, fuck. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's it, right? That's it. So he did... Ghostbusters and Stripes, Ghostbusters 2. And then I think Groundhog Day is basically his best film, but I think it's also one of the best films ever made. And then he followed that up with kind of like stuff where you go, oh, God, like none of this is... Groundhog Day. Have you ever seen Quick Change?
Yeah, yeah.
It's one of them really frustrating films where it's all set in one night and it's about people that can't escape a situation. So it's a little bit like After Hours. What's that other film that I saw? Oh, it's a little bit like Miracle Mile.
Oh, yeah.
Where you've got these... although After Hours is a straight-out comedy and Miracle Mile is kind of like a bit of a mishmash of stuff. But... yeah, Quick Change. It's got Gina Davis in it, who's brilliant. Randy Quaid again. And Bill Murray. I don't know if he wrote it, he directed it. And he plays a clown that does...
I don't know if I knew that.
He plays a clown that robs a bank. And it's got... it's got one line in it that I've quoted... my entire life, where he gets out of the prison. No, he gets out of the bank that he's just robbed, and he's in disguise. And he goes, hey, baby, up your butt with a coconut. it's funny stuff. But it is like one of them really, really, really frustrating films where they've got to do something very straightforward and simple, which is get out of town. And then they spend 90 minutes not being able to get out of town to get to the plane that they need to get on. And you're just, it just winds me up.
What about Bob? I guess it'd be another quite big one.
Yeah, I did mention that.
I did, yes.
What about Bob? Yeah, I think that's good. But it was kind of like one of the, do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, Steve Martin was so prolific in the 80s when you're kind of like growing up in a video shop and kind of like renting out Steve Martin every week. And there wasn't a lot of Bill Murray to pick from. So when he did pop up, it was kind of like in Little Shop of Horrors or something like that. You'd be kind of, but he's great in that, but in his one scene. But I was just so obsessed with Steve Martin at the time that no one else really got a look in. I did really like Bill Murray, but then, as I say, when you look back on it, there wasn't an awful lot to pick from. So when What About Bob came out in like 1990, that was like one of the things that, you know, you'd go around your mate's house and they'd rented it out from the video shop and you'd watch it there and then you'd kind of like watch it again.
When I was a kid...
But that's another...
Oh, no, I was going to say, when I was a kid, on the back of magazines, they'd often have like CIC video collections or whatever, and they used to have a Steve Martin one, which would be, you know, Roxanne, Man With Two Brains, The Jerk, All of Me, and they'd have a Schwarzenegger one, which would be Raw Deal, Predator.
Commando, yeah. Red Heat, Raw Deal, yeah.
And they were like franchises in themselves. And like it was only years later, I had no idea that most of those Steve Martin films didn't make money. I think of them as being such kind of standards of like all these like hit after hit after hit, only to find out that barely any of them made any money.
They're all classics. All of the, you look at all of those films. I mean, I saw All of Me at the cinema like last year, was it? And it's probably my least favourite out of all of those films. But like those Carl Reiner, early Steve Martin kind of films, including Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid, Man With Two Brains, Jerk. They're all classics. And I think what happened was it took VHS to make him a star, like an international megastar. And then it's kind of sickening to think that probably the film that he made, that his probably biggest earning movie that he ever made was something like Pink Panther or Cheaper by the Dozen, you know, where like much later in his career, but they were like these broad family films. And where you see, because I watched them recently, so it's kind of like you see these tiny little glimpses of Steve Martin actually going kind of like, oh, I'm going to put a bit of Steve Martin in here. But really, he's sort of like sleepwalking through these films, and then every so often he'll kind of like do a little like flourish with his hands, or he'll pull like a face. And it's sort of like, it's so bizarre to see kind of like 80s, 90s Steve Martin poking through in all of these kind of like 2000 films, where it's almost like you go, don't bother, just stop. And I am like a total Steve Martin, I wouldn't say apologist, but like I can admit when, I mean, I was the only person to laugh at one joke in the packed cinema when I went to see Pink Panther. And as soon as I laughed, I covered my mouth out of embarrassment, because it echoed around that fucking room. Like, I can admit and acknowledge, I mean, I've seen Sergeant Bilko more times than I care to admit, but like, and it is a bad one, but when you compare it to some of the stuff that happened later, you know, you didn't realise you were bathing in honey in the Gardens of Eden. It was like Sergeant, I'd take Sergeant Bilko over, you know, the last fucking 10 films that he made. But I think as I've gone on record many times, I think he's earned his right to never make a good film ever again.
Sure.
Because he just made wall-to-wall bangers for like 20 years. And then he had like a career as a playwright, a novelist, a musician, an art collector. Do you know what I mean? He's sort of like, he's a magician. Before he was even a comedian, he was a magician.
In a way, he's sort of retired. He's almost retired from making... So I've done that.
Now yeah, and he pops up in
my other hobbies.
One of the things that I was like happiest with at the beginning of my career was that quite early on, when I made enough money, I bought tickets for me and my dad to go and see Steve Martin at the Hammersmith Apollo. And I remember it was his him and his band. And it was going to be like bluegrass and banjo and stuff. And I remember thinking, because it wasn't comedy, it was him as a musician. And I bought the tickets like months in advance. And I remember thinking, well, he's not Woody Allen in terms of comedy. He's not Woody Allen, so he's probably going to talk to the audience. He's got some level of showmanship, whereas when Woody Allen like played jazz and stuff, he'd have his back to the audience and he'd just play his clarinet and he wouldn't talk to anyone. He'd just sort of like come on and do music. So I did sort of like have an inkling that Steve Martin might talk to the audience. And then I remember like a week before the show came out, a week before the show was on, it said Steve Martin and his band plus comedy, and then they started kind of like really hammering the fact that he's going to talk, don't worry, he's going to do some. And so when you
I think at the time I had that same thought, like, I don't know if I want to see him play a banjo for 2 hours.
He's a really great musician, but, like, he doesn't sing either. So he's written these songs. I mean, he did sing in the, like, 70s and stuff when he thought, like, he did songs like King Tut. And he was a musician back then. You know, there was, like, that flip side. It's like the Steve Martin Brothers album, where on one side he's, like, Steve Martin with grey hair, and on the other side it's him when he looked a little bit like Jim Morrison. He looks like Harrison Ford wearing a Jim Morrison wig.
He does. I saw some footage of, is it John Fogerty from Creedence Clearwater Revival?
Yeah, exactly like Steve Martin.
Exactly like Steve Martin.
And that is, it's crazy. There's a bunch of people that look like this, that look the same. I think it's like Steve Martin, Harrison Ford, John Fogerty. I think there's someone else, and they all kind of like look like you could just exchange them in kind of like biopics.
Yeah. You know? It's weird, isn't it? You've got that poster of Steve Martin, that the one you're talking about, from that era, and... you sort of, it's remarkable, like, how handsome he is. He really does look like an absolute, like, leading man.
There he is. He's up there, but you can only see his hand clutching that famous banjo of his. yeah. So when we went to the Hammersmith, it was, like, 3/4 full, and there was like, empty seats and stuff. And all of the jokes that he did basically ended up on that Martin Short, an evening you'll forget for the rest of your life.
Oh, really?
Netflix special. Which was fine.
Weren't we?
My dad is such a huge... he liked Steve Martin as a comedian, but he plays the banjo, or he used to play the banjo, and he's like a musician. So my dad enjoyed it just on like the musical level. But it was like one of those things. I've never had enough money to be able to buy my parents a house, you know, which is like the ultimate dream of showbiz. But I did manage to, with one of my first paychecks, go to watch one of my heroes enjoy Steve Martin for an evening. There you go.
Things before COVID, wasn't it? It was like the week we were going to go to Royal Festival Hall, weren't we, to see Martin?
We were going to go to Royal Festival Hall. You didn't go to see Bill Murray with me, did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, we went to see Bill Murray together, didn't we?
Hmm.
That was like a different experience where that felt like everyone had drank the Kool-Aid in that room, where it was Steve Martin reading aloud next to a cellist.
Bill Murray.
Was that it's Bill Murray reading aloud works of American literature, stood next to a cellist. And everyone was going absolutely fucking mental. And it was just kind of like, what is this? What is this? Because he's not a stand-up, so I wasn't expecting him to do stand-up. But I don't know what I was expecting. But it was kind of like
I had a lot of fun.
In retrospect, like, I remember the Steve Martin evening, like, with a lot of fondness. I can still remember it, but like the Bill Murray one, the further I get away from it, the more I think, what a self-indulgent evening.
Well, weirdly, I listened to, because they did it, it was based on an album I'd never heard at that point. And then afterwards, I'd kind of listened to bits of it and I was going, I actually like a lot of this. Like,
I think it probably makes a lot more sense in the context.
Yeah.
You know. But also, I went to see Bernadette Peters at the Royal Festival Hall, and again, that was her singing, and you go, fucking hell, she's great at singing. And then all of her anecdotes were about how much the tickets cost and how expensive her Malibu complex is. And you go, maybe less of that, and just do some more singing.
Because I think they forget, don't they? Like those tickets, those Bill Murray tickets were expensive, and they were certainly expensive for me. And people talk about it like, hey, tickets are expensive. And you sort of, you kind of want to go, yeah, they are, actually. Do you know what I mean? They might not be for you, but they really are quite expensive. So go about it.
They are. And they also have that sort of like old school showbiz thing, which is kind of like, you're happy because I'm rich.
Mm.
And I can tell you what it's like to be rich. And you go, well, we've got like reality TV with the Kardashians and stuff like that. So we know what it's like being rich. So I'm not going to be happy just because you're rich. Do something. Sing your fucking song and fuck off. Although I am in love with Bernadette Peters, so that doesn't really go with that. But it's like when I saw the tickets for Bill Murray, it's like one of those things where you go, Bill Murray is at the Royal Festival Hall. What, the Bill Murray or a Bill Murray?
Yeah.
Can't be. Is it Christopher Lloyd? Oh, I've got tickets to see Christopher Lloyd do a talk. And you turn up and it's the fucking producer. Oh, dear.
I saw, when I was waiting to go in, did you see her as well? Thingy was in there. Tilda Swinton was at the Royal Festival.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
I was quite excited to see her in the flesh. She's sort of a weird, quite iconic person, she, who I almost don't imagine exists in real life. So I was quite excited to see her.
Yeah, she doesn't look real when she's on film. And so... Mm. When you see her in real life, you know.
Also, and of course she is. Of course she is. But what was the other thing that was interesting to see her was that she was obviously just laughing and joking and having a night out and just seemed to be smiling. And you go, oh, right, yeah, of course. She's just like this, just having a bit of a night out. She's having a nice time.
Sure. She probably would have got a free ticket off him, you know.
Sure.
She of course she was enjoying herself. She hadn't just spent 80 quid. Right? For the most self-indulgent evening of entertainment I've ever seen. My show's excluded. So we've got to play a song, and then we've actually got to... We're ruining Christmas for a lot of people. Some people don't like Bill Murray or Steve Martin or Tilda Swinton or Bernadette Peters. We've got to save... Nathaniel, we've got to save Christmas! So let's play a song, and then let's save Christmas!
S-A-N-T-A-C-L-A-W-S. Santa Claus. Oh, you better watch out. You better not cry. Telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town. Oh, he's making a list, checking it twice. Gonna find out who's naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town. He sees you when you're sleeping. He knows when you're awake. Knows when you've been bad or good, so be good for goodness sake. So you better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout. I'm telling you why Santa Claus is coming to town, your town. He knows where you live. He knows that your window's open. He knows what lives under your bed. We'll be right back. Toot and Rummy Dum Dums. Santa Claus is coming to town. Little toy dolls that cuddle and coo. Elephant bears that puddle and poo. Santa Claus is coming to town. The kids and girl in Boyland will have a jubilee. They're gonna build a toyland town all around the Christmas tree. And then they're gonna burn it down. You better watch out. You better not cry. Better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming. Santa Claus is coming. Santa Claus is coming to town. Your town. We're gonna break all the toys. And then we're gonna make some noise. We're gonna party all night long. We're gonna sing this song. Gonna party all night long. We're gonna sing this song. Santa Claus is coming to town. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It's Christmas! It's still Christmas! It's still Christmas! How exciting! Christmas is my favourite day of any year, and this year it's even better because I'm on my own in my flat. I love it. I'm having a lovely Christmas day with my best mate Nathaniel Metcalf, and we're here doing... one of the things I thought was that we always kind of like save our guest as a surprise.
Yeah.
But then we always advertise the show as this is our guest.
Yeah, you're right.
Whenever we tweet
that doesn't make sense. It's because we
so
do.
There's not really... I think also kind of like... I think I'm in sort of disbelief that our guest even shows up.
Well, actually, I think at this point, for us doing it, there is always that possibility that they might not turn up. It's happened before.
It has happened. fucking hell, the very first one. Oh, the very first fan club, I guess. Maybe that was it. It sort of like scared us into the fact that well, never rely on... And I've not always shown...
Don't rely on anyone. That's a Christmas message.
I had to film a Christmas thing for Dave in early autumn once, and I was late to the show, wasn't I? So there was that.
Were you coming in glitter or something?
I think fake snow, maybe it was. Did we wrap up on what our favourite Christmas carol version was?
I think so. I think mine. I said Alistair Sim. You said you didn't like Alistair Sim.
I don't think I've seen the Alistair Sim version.
Oh, right.
It's like one of those. But like, maybe my favourite ever version of a Christmas Carol is Blackadder's Christmas Carol, which I just, which I really love, because for anyone that wanted another series of Blackadder, then you've got kind of like this episode that's set in Victorian era London, and it's outside of. It's just another one of the Blackadder ancestors, and it's about Blackadder learning to be a cunt. And it was really funny, and it also sort of like scratches that itch of like, what if there was another series, and you kind of like have like this special. So I watched a film. I think Muppet's Christmas Carol was probably. Talking of favourite Christmas films, so I would say my favourite Christmas films are Muppet's Christmas Carol, which has that song. Speaking of kind of like giving Scrooge like a bit of backstory, it had that song where young Scrooge is walking through a park with his lost love. And then they cut that because it was there weren't enough puppets in it and it was too boring and slow. So it's not in... it's not in a lot of the DVD releases, and then they're making a big thing at the moment because they're reinserting it back into the film. So there's this film that kind of like is quite catchy. Da-da-da love, da-da-da love. Da, 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 da. And in actual fact, at the end of the film, there's a callback to that song where they do a reprise, but a reprise, a biopic. So they do a reprise of the song, but the song isn't actually in the film anymore. And so I think they've reinserted it into the film. That's like the big thing. So I think Muppets Christmas Carol is great. I really love Santa Claus the Movie with Dudley Moore. And I always used to watch that on Christmas Eve while I was wrapping presents. And then
that's a much better movie than I think it gets credit for. I think that's
people think it's awful. I think John Lithgow's great in it, and it's the reason why I like Dudley Moore.
Yeah, it's also like it's produced by the Soulkind people, isn't it? It did the Superman movies, and when you watch it, it's called Santa Claus the Movie, and it's basically like Superman the Movie, and it's taken this iconic thing and it gives him an origin, and it's basically almost like Superman. It's like Superman the Movie, but with Santa Claus.
He's got a Lex Luthor villain, he's got a Richard Pryor-esque sidekick. It's kind of like, I think it was made around the same time as Supergirl.
Yeah, and movies have got a really similar structure to them.
It was this huge sort of like disaster at the time, but I absolutely bloody love it. And then I always really love National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation, which I think is the best out of the vacation movies. I rewatched the first vacation film recently, and it's like one of those films where Chevy Chase is so good in 90% of the film, and then there's some bits where he like overdoes it, and yeah, okay. But because of all of like the broad slapstick, gross out comedies that followed it, it kind of feels really tame now. Where you kind of like go, oh my god, they've killed a dog. Oh my god, the grandma's died in the car. It's kind of like you go, yeah. I even probably prefer European Vacation, even though that's famously people hate that film. But
I like that. But then I had both of them growing up on video, and I reckon I watched European Vacation more. I think I particularly liked it because it felt like it was kind of connected more with British comedy by having, you know, Mel Smith
and Eric Hyde. Yeah. Definitely. But I really, really love Christmas Vacation. I think it's like one of those... that's almost like Christmas tradition to watch that every
year. I think it's quite a nice one for me, Christmas Vacation, because I remember going to see that at the cinema with my dad. And again, I know it was one I used to see advertised in comic books, and it came out in the UK, I think, a whole year after it came out in the States, because it's Christmassy. And then I was really excited to see it. I went to see it with my dad, and I think I would have seen it was about 10 or 11, I think, when it came out. And my dad, when he'd take me to the cinema, would always be bored, stiff, or have a sleep because he didn't want to see films I wanted to watch. And I remember him going to see Willow with him and him spending the whole film asleep. But I remember Christmas Vacation coming out and him going, that was great. And it was like the first film I remember seeing with him where we both had like a similar experience of both really liking this film on the same level.
I think it's interesting. It's like it's a Christmas film that is aimed squarely at dads.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's a comedy and everyone can enjoy it. But I think it's like a thing that's about the sentimentality and the frustration of, well, that's what all of the films are about. It's about a dad, despite his flaws, just really, really trying to pull out all the stops to do something great for his family, even though he's a dick. And Christmas Vacation is sort of like those films kind of really justify their sequels because they go on an American vacation and then it's like, well, what do we do next? And then it's like, well, we go on a European vacation. And what do you do next? Well, we'll do a Christmas one where it's like a Christmas at home. And I think that they're all different from each other, but they're all sort of, and all the kids are always different, but they all sort of like justify. Yeah. I think that.
And I saw Vegas Vacation about 2 or 3 years ago. I'd never seen it before.
Oh, I hate it.
It sort of feels like a sort of false sequel, doesn't it? It doesn't really feel like.
It's not National Lampoon's. It's just called Vegas Vacation. It's not National Lampoon's Vegas Vacation. And from what I remember, it's like laugh free. Like there aren't any there aren't any real jokes in it, and it just goes on and on and on, and it's kind of like, yeah. And I think that's where you go, you've already sort of done that in Vacation. You're just going on holiday in America again. It's not bringing really anything new other than the fact that they're just trying to make another film out of it. So I think, yeah, it's a nice little trilogy of films. What about you? What are your favourite Christmas films?
Well, my number one is always It's Wonderful Life, because I think it's my favourite film anyway, and I kind of have to watch that every year. But I would say Scrooged is one that I do. Haven't done it this year, but I do it most every year.
Scrooged.
Scrooged. Yeah. And I'd probably do, yeah, I'd probably do the Alistair Sim one quite regularly. But, yeah, I do like them. And I think they're the ones that I think, like this year, I'm sort of thinking, oh, what shall I try and line up for Christmas? And I might do Batman Returns. I don't know, maybe.
Yeah, I think that you can watch. I think that after Christmas, no. But before Christmas on the lead up, sure. I'd say that my two least favourite Christmas films of all time ever are Jingle All the Way, which is awful. And got what?
I was going to say, I didn't see that till later. And it was a lot better than I thought it was going to be. I remember being like pleasantly surprised.
No, I remember the trailers coming out, and it's like got Arnold Schwarzenegger punching, beating up a bunch of Santa Clauses and stuff. And you just think, oh, great, they've made like this action comedy Christmas film. And then it's not that, and it's just fucking terrible. And I think we've talked about it before, but like if they'd have gone the True Lies, he's like the head of like a, I don't know. Steve Martin's the head of a trainer company in Father of the Bride. So he's like the head of some sort of like local company, and he's obsessed with work, and then he needs to buy his kid a present. And it's kind of like, you should have just made him like a secret agent who is busy saving the world. And the one thing that he's forgot to do is buy his kid a present. And that's the thing that he finds the most challenging and the biggest struggle is that, oh my God, it's James Bond, or it's Commando at Christmas, and he can't get his kid the present that he wants. And that's why he's got all of like these special skills that he's going around beating up all these Santa Clauses and fighting Sinbad oh my God, it's so fucking awful. Although it's got one of the last all-time great Phil Hartman performances in it.
Yes, it does. It's great, isn't it?
He's great. He's the reason to watch it, but the film is just dog shit.
I think I thought it was much more cynical film than it turned out to be. You go, it's kind of quite sweet. It's kind of, I don't know, I'd avoided it for a long time just thinking it looked awful.
It's so badly executed, you know. But I think that it's a generational thing. I think if you grew up watching it, it's probably like Santa Claus the movie. If you grew up watching it, then it's probably, and the other one is The Grinch. Where the Jim Carrey one, where every time I watch that, I just get incredibly claustrophobic and feel kind of like I'm having like a panic attack or a fever dream.
I saw that a couple of years ago. But again, weirdly, I thought that was better than I imagined it was going to be. They're the sort of films that I avoided. Apparently, it's a thing that Ron Howard made. He made it when he did because he realised that CGI was taking over everything. And if he didn't make it now, he wouldn't be able to make it how he wanted to do it. So it's almost like it's almost entirely practical effects. And now it gives it a more classic-y feel, I think, because it's almost made after a time that they were doing CGI, but were deliberately using... who did that? Who did the makeup?
Rick Baker.
Rick Baker, right, yeah. Mm. So it's all Rick Baker and practical effects. And now when you watch it, it feels much more... Well, it feels kind of more 80s-y than you think it is. It's that kind of... that it actually is. Because it's like you're so used to seeing CGI now. When you watch it, it feels kind of very old fashioned and quite big. It's on a sort of big scale, you know.
I think that's one of the things. It's kind of like I feel like Jim Carrey was really claustrophobic in the makeup, so you feel kind of claustrophobic through that. But also, it's all filmed on sound stages, which I normally don't have a problem with, but because it's so sort of like. It feels like so gaudy, like Batman and Robin, where it just feels like it's just a relentless headache of like neon and sound stages and bright colours and kind of like it's difficult to really know what Jim Carrey's aiming at with his.
I think it's one of the big issues with kind of Tim Burton's films in general, that Tim Burton's films work best when they're on sound stages because he gets to create this whole kind of vision. And you do get this idea that he's doing it. Whereas something like, when you watch something like Planet of the Apes, it's so much weaker looking than the original Planet of the Apes because it's on sound stages. And it kind of looks cheaper because it isn't outside, essentially. It feels like you're in this weird, like totally false environment. It feels like you're on a set all the time.
What, on Planet of the Apes?
Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, but I would say that Pee-wee's Big Adventure is maybe his best film.
Yeah, you're right,
And that is just, that is kind of like Tim Burton in the real world. That's him. He's created like this fantasy land, but it's very much like filmed on street corners and in landmarks and stuff. And I think Pee-wee's Big Adventure, in terms of plot and in terms of like as a film hanging together, I think Tim Burton is obviously, I think it's true. Like when you watch his Batman films and it's style over substance, the plot doesn't keep you entertained, but moment by moment, it sort of gets you through. But with Pee-wee's Big Adventure, there's a really great plot that like drags you through it. And he's so on the cusp of being an irritating character, but he never is. And he's actually lovable. I think Pee-wee's Big Adventure is like one of, I think on a personal level, it's one of my favorite films. And I think it's Tim Burton's best film.
Yeah, I haven't seen that. I'd like to see it again.
It's great. Anyway, speaking of which, we've got 4 minutes to talk about stuff that we've seen. For our sins, the big Christmas release on Sky is Dr. Dolittle, starring Robert Downey Jr. I woke up very early on Christmas morning and I've watched it. I've just finished watching it just before we started recording the show. And I have to say it did indeed do very little for me. it's crazy. It's a crazy film. It's set in like a fantasy. It's sort of Victorian, but there's a queen in it, and it's not Queen Victoria. It's sort of like this fantasy land that has. Dragons and stuff in it. There's two things that stood out for me. One of them is that they nick the whole translation gimmick from Hunt for Red October, where in Hunt for Red October there's a guy speaking in Russian, and then is apocalypse the word? There's a word that's the same in English and Russian, and so John McTiernan famously directed the best Christmas film, Die Hard. In Hunt for Red October, John McTiernan slowly zooms into a guy speaking Russian's mouth. And when he gets to the word, I think it's apocalypse, but it might be something else. But when he gets to the word apocalypse, which is the same in English and Russian, it starts zooming out again. And then the actor starts speaking in English. Mm. And in Dr. Dolittle, there's this endless sequence near the beginning where he's talking like a gorilla. And then it zooms into one of the animal's mouths, and then the animal starts speaking in English, and it zooms out again. And you go, you've nicked that from the Hunt for Red October. That's absolutely insane. And then there's another bit later on where he puts on like one of these copper diving helmets, and he's being dangled off a boat. And then it zooms into his diving helmet, and you see Robert Downey Jr.'s face behind this glass screen. And it's like, what, like Tony Stark in Iron Man? You know, they do like an Iron Man joke. And you kind of like go, right, is that meant to be a reference to Iron Man? Is that not? But he basically does this impenetrable, it's meant to be a Welsh accent in it. Where he's kind of trying all the way through. He sounds like Harry Seacombe. He sounds like he's doing a bad Harry Seacombe impression. And it was based on like a historical figure. But it's kind of difficult. He's trying to basically outdo Johnny Depp. And I guess it's because he's already done Sherlock. So he's trying to come up with an alternative British accent. So he's gone Welsh. But it feels like the whole performance has been done in post-production, like ADR, where the beginning of the film, so many shots of him talking are of the back of his head, or he's got a teacup in front of his mouth, or he's wearing a surgical mask. And then he'll face the camera for his reaction shot, and then he'll turn his head away when he's got to talk. And it's kind of like, at what point did all of that happen? Because it's like they planned to do most of the film in ADR anyway. But it's quite weird, because the talking animals seem more like they're talking than Robert Downey Jr. for the majority of the film. It got panned at the time, but I didn't think it was going to be quite as bad as they said it was, and it's worse. Apparently in the test screenings, kids were getting up and running around and crying and fighting each other because they were bored, and I got up halfway through and I watched the second half of the film from the kitchen while I was making soup. So, from scratch, you know, not out of a sachet, but like it was...
You burnt your cheek.
That's how I burnt my cheek. And that was on Christmas morning. And you watched The Keep. So what makes The Keep...
Well, the Christmassy connection to The Keep that my friend Rob Wynne had me a couple of years ago is that the end theme of The Keep is Tangerine Dream doing a cover of Walking in the Air. But just because they obviously like the music, but you just can't hear it without going The Snowman. I guess it's less famous in America.
I don't think The Snowman was a hit. The Snowman is one of those films that's grown over the years. And in the 80s, The Keep was very early 80s, wasn't it? They would have just picked the tune that they liked, and then it became like this snowball. It snowballed.
Yes.
So it's on the hour, so we're going to play a song, and then we're going to get our guest in. Is that right?
Yes.
What are we going to play?
His choice, which is this.
Get many things right the first time. In fact, I am told that a lot. Now I know all the wrong turns and stumbles and falls brought me here. I next door. There's an old man who lived to his 90s and one day passed away in his sleep.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
It's Christmas! It's Christmas! It's Christmas! And we're back live on Christmas Day. It's not live. It is live. It is live. This is one of the few of the year that we've done absolutely live on Christmas Day. My turkey's in the oven. I'm getting ready for... I'm not doing turkey. I'm doing gammon, I think. And I definitely am, because I got it out of the packet. And we're in the studio. We're not in the studio. I'm in my living room. Nat's in his washroom. And we're joined now by... I say this a lot, but I'm going to say it again. We're joined by living legend, Mr. Richard Herring.
Hello.
Hello. Hello, how are you? Merry Christmas.
Happy Christmas. Oh, my family are so cross with me coming up to do this for an hour.
A whole hour.
What a scheduling fuck-up. I normally do this at Easter, because there's normally like a gap in my diary at Easter. And I'll be like, oh, I've got nothing on that weekend. I'll book a gig in the middle of fucking nowhere. I think I was meant to be in Plymouth this Easter. And then people go, what are you doing for Easter? And you go, oh, yeah, I'm going to Plymouth. I'm going to be... on my own on Easter Sunday. But you've done very similar today. How is your Christmas going so far?
Well, it's Richard, lovely. Over. It's beautiful. We're following whatever the guidelines are now, today. Certainly like a week or two ago, we were allowed to do this. Whether we are now, I don't know. So there's three
houses.
I think
the rules are now, it's like The Purge, isn't it? It's like the film The Purge. I think you can kill people in anything today.
Great. Well, I'm sure that will happen. Maybe not here, yes. But somewhere. It's a stressful time. Anyway, normally I quite like my COVID year of not having to socialise or see my... I miss my mum and dad, who I'm not seeing. But, you know, not having to do family things. It's been all right.
I'm sort of really stressed out about... I have been really stressed out about Christmas presents this year.
Okay.
I just don't think I'm going to get many. It's worrying. Yeah. No, when I think back, normally what I would do is I'd go back to my parents' hometown, St Albans, the day before Christmas Eve, and then I would do all my shopping on Christmas Eve, and I would get it done in about 2 hours, and then I would wrap it all, and then I would go out, and then I would ruin Christmas by getting drunk.
And
I'm not. I've not done that this year.
No.
But I don't know why I'm finding the prospect. I think it's because everyone is telling you that Christmas shopping has gone haywire, and that's the reason we've not been allowed to see our loved ones today. Mm-hmm. It's a shame.
Keep it up. Keep the energy up for the people at home.
Sorry, it's Christmas. Yeah, it's Christmas. You. Sorry. Thank you. You're right.
It's mainly for the radio, but me and Nick have dressed. I've got a Christmas jumper on. Nick's got an Alice Cooper Christmas T-shirt.
Yeah. That's right.
And a Santa Claus hat.
Yeah.
But Richard, you're in a room with a green screen behind you.
Obviously, you can put anything you want behind me.
Yeah.
And then it can be whatever you like. I've got a Pickle Rick Christmas T-shirt. I've got a few Rick and Morty Christmas T-shirts. We might talk about Rick and Morty later, but my wife bought me three jumpers, Christmas jumpers that are Rick and Morty themed. One of them is Pickle Rick, so I should have worn one of those, but I did wear it the other day when we went to meet Santa Claus the other day, me and my children.
How was that? Can you touch Santa this year?
We
were socially distanced, although, you know, when it's kids, little kids, they're allowed to be close to each other because apparently they can't spread it to each other somehow by magic. And presumably Father Christmas can't either. It was lovely. It was very nice, actually. I've got a photo of both. Well, every year my daughter's been alive and my son missed one because we had some kind of bug. 1 year, but my daughter get increasingly more comfortable with Father Christmas, but she's always been quite suspicious of him. The first couple are screaming and just looking terrified. She now accepts that an old man will come into her house and give her presents and accepts that is fine, but she is still suspicious, I think. But my son is completely into it and was blathering on about the North Pole, even though there was a group of kids there.
I kept my belief of Santa Claus going for about 3 or 4 years after the fact that it was believable. I think that my parents were quite worried that there was a 14, 15-year-old kid that was still going, so what's Santa Claus going to get me? And then it was just like, we've got to tell him at some point.
Yeah. Did you have older brothers and sisters?
I got an older sister.
Okay. That usually is the way you find out.
I think she kept it going. No, we were just greedy. We just wanted double presents every year. Keep it going out of guilt. I did notice that when Nat was mentioning that he was wearing a Christmas jumper and I was wearing a Christmas T-shirt, that you looked down at the ground next to your chair to see if you could find any, Christmas...
I was just saying, because I've been doing... I probably have a Christmas hat here somewhere. I filmed sketches up here, so I was just looking to see if I had any... I had a Christmas hat. I'll tell you what I'll do.
It's desperate panic. Here he is. Yes.
There we go. It's Christmas.
He's only going to bloody save Christmas. That's the best. How much has having children changed the world? We're going to talk about Christmas, I think.
Yeah, so, that's good.
How much? It's Christmas Day. So this is for all the people that are cooking their dinners and wanting something to listen to on Christmas Day. How has Christmas with kids changed your outlook on it?
I mean, it's much more fun. It's much more fun. I still feel a little bit that Christmas comes around too quickly. I think once a year is too often. But obviously when you're a kid, a year is a long time. But when you're a 53-year-old man, like, it only feels like yesterday we were doing Christmas with, you know, like, because it starts in November. And then, you know, we'd listen to the Muppet Christmas Carol, which I love. Well, it just comes around too quick. So I would propose have Christmas every other year, or maybe like the Olympics every 4 years. So it's really special. But having kids, it is. And I think my kids now are 3 and nearly 6. And so it's a golden period. They both understand what it is. They're both really excited. And all of that stuff. They are waking up on Christmas morning and seeing kids opening their presents is brilliant. So that, I think once you've got kids and putting... I never used to put up Christmas trees or decorations or anything when I lived alone. So I think, like, being drawn back into it a bit and having a family makes it a bit more meaningful. It's fun.
I hope there aren't kids listening to this on Christmas Day, because they've probably been for a shock. I can't imagine that there's many... children that would listen to this on Christmas morning, but we'll see. So you're in this green room. Is this a room that you've deliberately made green?
Well, it's a screen, so I can take it up and down. This is my attic in my house where I do all my podcasts from now this year. We set it up just before lockdown. We were sort of intending to do it anyway. Just in case we wanted to start doing little bits and pieces. But I play snooker up here and against myself, and I film that. So if I take that down, you can see. Snooker table. Maybe you can't see because it's a bit dark.
With that green screen, it must be a bit confusing as to where to put the balls. There we go.
Yeah, it is. It's good. So I've been doing lots of stuff. I've been doing lots of stuff from up here. I've got puppets. I've started doing a puppet show on Thursday night. It's called Twitch of Fun. Ali and Herring's Twitch of Fun. I've got a 128-year-old ventriloquist dummy called Ali. I'll show him to you. That my great granddad made. He might start doing a few gigs soon. Hello, it's me, Ali. Ha ha ha. I'm cheeky knee. Hello. Yes, that's right. It's me.
It's got the sort of slightly wiggy hair front. That's quite a nice gag, isn't it? That he's got that sort of. That's a good gag. That's
128-year-old joke. Is one of his eyes doesn't open properly. I can never remember which one. So his catchphrase is, I'm winking at it whenever he says something rude. I've just developed... I mean, it is falling apart, like his clothes are falling apart. He's pretty dirty. He looks a bit like Stuart Lee as well, so it's a sort of almost homage to my, to my old... It's the 90s era Stuart Lee, so it's a little bit of a homage. But then I've ended up doing I've got a Prince Andrew puppet that someone made me a Prince Andrew puppet and sent it to me unsolicited. Look at that. How good is that?
That's incredible.
I mean, this is a proper.
It's quite Thunderbird-y, actually, isn't it? Yeah. I've got it really, really works.
Yes, hello, it's new. I was in Dietrich's dress in King Ordon, so didn't have to worry about me. And so, yes, and I've been having fun.
You've got the listeners at home. It was probably lost on the listeners at home, but Richard Herring's ventriloquism skills are second to none.
It's amazing, isn't it? I've decided to do it. The ventriloquist dummy turned up in the snooker. It used to be just me one versus me two, but over lockdown I did 32 players in tournaments, and one of the players was controlled by the ventriloquist dummy. And I kind of thought, there's something in this. And then also I've done like 20 odd weeks of shows, so I just thought I'd practice it as I do it, you know. And so the joke is that it doesn't matter if it's good or not. As we were discussing when we were filming, weren't we, Nick, that you showed me a guy doing and you know, that's funny as well. So it's kind of funny when you can't say your bees, but I listened to Nina Conti, who's going to be a guest on my podcast soon, on Adam Buxton, and she gave some quite good advice about how to try and say the letter B. I'm actually trying to get technically okay at it, but it's more about having, you know, it's this thing of the internet now is you know, anyone can broadcast. So being like a guy who used to be on TV 25 years ago, broadcasting from your attic, it's kind of fun to play around. It's fun to play around with whether I'm having a mental breakdown or whether this is, you know, and I'm not quite sure.
It's a good cover for whether or not you're having a mental breakdown.
Yeah, but that's sort of part. So some people generally think I'm in trouble, and maybe I am. I mean, I do a lot of slightly crazy things. This is the King of the World. He was on, as it occurs to me, he was King Midas, and then Chris Evans got that one, sent him to me in a box because he'd been looking after him, and as he came out of the box, the character appeared, and he went, "I'm the King of the World! I'm the King of the World!" And all he does is say, "I'm the King of the World," and if you quiz him on it, he just says, because I'm the King of the World. That's right. And the King of the World. And the King of the World. And that's the whole character. But people seem to love that one the best of all. So his head's coming off a bit. So, yeah, so I've been doing that. So that's why I've got a green screen. So I can do. We've been doing a few. I brought back Peter Dibden, who was the driving instructor's character I did in Fist of Fun, because I grew a moustache for Movember, which I carried on having for the short film, the film that me and Nick were in this month.
Are you going to have to talk about that film?
I don't know if we're allowed to. I think she tweets about it a lot, so I think we're allowed to.
I think we are. I mean, she sent all the pictures. Yeah, how did you get involved? We made a film called...
She actually got in touch via Instagram. I only joined it... I've only started doing Instagram in the last couple of months, really. And so a few people kind of contacted. It was sort of a weird place to try and contact someone and offer them a job, I thought. But luckily, I checked my inbox, which I hadn't done for the rest of the time I've been there. She just offered me that part. So I don't know why. I mean, it's a sort of... a self-obsessed showbiz dad. So I guess that there was a reason she thought of me. I don't know. But and I'm playing your dad as well. I've thought of myself as like a young uncle to Nick Helm. I've never thought of myself as being a father figure to Nick Helm. But
you mentioned then you were 53. How do you feel about playing the dad of the 40-year-old Nick Helm?
Well, Marek Larwood, who was on my podcast, that's the one that's gone out to... a week and a bit ago, off from Christmas Day, he was saying, "You should start, whatever the first line is, go, 'I fucked your mum when I was 12. I fucked your mum when I was 12. I should just put that in. So I neglected to do that because I was just about to go and film the first day when I talked to him. It's fine. They aged me up, which is fine. And, you know, Nick, I think Nick was playing younger than he was. I think Nick looked older than me. He's quite fucked up.
But also, there wasn't... my beard grew. I had 5 days of filming over 2 weeks.
Right.
And you turned up on set with a moustache. And at the beginning of filming, I had a moustache. Right. But my beard had sort of slightly grown through a bit, so my moustache wasn't as prominent.
Oh, okay.
But it did... By just fluke, we did have, like, a family resemblance. We didn't particularly have any dialogue together.
I didn't really have a dialogue with anyone. I was basically, I just bolted into scenes, did a monologue and fucked off again. So I hardly related to another actor in the whole time. I think I looked at you once when I pretended you were looking like you were going to interrupt me, but you weren't. The woman playing my wife, who was brilliant, I didn't get to talk to her. So I was only in the scene with the main with the main character, and it was sort of talking at her. I hugged her and then talked at her and didn't look at her. And she said, "You didn't look at me. That's brilliant." And I hadn't really done it on purpose. but she said, "That's exactly like my dad." But it turns out I was playing basically a real person. You know, Laura's dad, was in a band, and he married someone from Pan's People, was his second wife. So that I was the dad, and that was the woman from Pan's People.
I didn't know the full background. I knew it's based
I didn't until afterwards. If I'd know, I should have researched the character first, shouldn't I? He was in a quite big band and married a Pan, which to youngsters, that might not mean very much, but Pan's People were the sexiest women in the 1970s. So he did well.
One of them married Robert Powell, didn't she?
That's right, yeah, I think that's right, yeah, yeah.
Robert Powell, the worst Jesus.
Wait, why is he the worst Jesus?
We had this conversation 2 weeks ago where we talked about Robert Powell.
I like Robert Powell. Got a lot of time for him.
3 weeks ago.
It's difficult to be the best Jesus because, you know, Jesus was also Jesus and he was pretty...
Well, he's up there. He's like the Charlie Chaplin runner-up prize for Jesus's. So in terms of... Do you enjoy acting?
I do, but I'm sort of glad that I don't get offered to. It's fun, but it's also quite boring, isn't it? That's the thing. Unless you're absolutely the main part. And then it's quite hard if you're the main part. But there's a lot of sitting around. The second day I went in, when I just briefly saw you, it was literally 40 minutes and then we went home again. And that was great. That's perfect for me. And we weren't sitting in a cold church. But I was in a church from 7:30 till about 12 hours in a cold church, and... You know, I didn't really get to say anything until after lunch. So it was that's what acting is.
Also, they did your shots when everyone else had been wrapped for the day.
I was there much too early and I stayed later than most people. And there was one scene where I was in the background. If I was a big star, I could have gone, I can get someone else to put on my jacket and stand in the background of a shot. I wasn't even face to camera. But I do like it. And I like doing it every now and again. But I think, you've done way more than I have. Maybe you could combine it with work, you know, if I'd taken my computer and had a charger, which I didn't have on the day, I could have sat down and done some writing on the stuff, other stuff I was doing, you know. But there's so much
sitting around when you're on a set. And I remember we did the Reluctant Landlord Christmas special last year when we filmed that. And there were three scenes. There were these three little scenes that we had. And the director on the day said, well, because it's all set in a pub, and they said, well, we're just going to combine all these three scenes into one mega scene. And it was basically Ramesh walking from the pool table to the bar, and on the way he was going to chat to these different people. And so he walked past me and I say something, and I'm decorating the tree. I put on like two baubles and some tinsel, and we filmed that for two 12-hour days. And I was in the background of shot. Yeah. I was right at the beginning, so I got my acting out of the way within the first 4 hours of the first day of filming. Yeah. And then the rest of the scene took like another kind of 15 hours. And I had to remember which baubles I put on in which order and which tinsel, just in case I was registered in the background shot. That was a fucking nightmare.
Yeah, so it's a lot like that, whereas, you know, I think I like doing things that throw away and quit. Not necessarily throwaway, but quick. So, like, stand-up works really well for me because you go on and do it, and if there's a mistake, you've got to deal with it. Doing this stuff I'm doing on Twitch is great for me because it's, you know, and the podcast generally, because it's just a conversation. You do a bit of prep for it, you work out what you're going to possibly cover. But doing this puppet show is literally pretty much all improvised. I've started scripting a couple of bits in it now. That's sort of what I want to be doing rather than learning lines, which I'm finding a bit harder than I used to. And, you know, and then it is just the waiting around. So I've really enjoyed the acting jobs I've done, but they've all pretty much all been quite short, except for maybe I did a thing called You Can Choose Your Friends, which I wrote and was one of the main characters of. It was quite an ensemble piece, which I guess there was a bit more acting in that for me to do. But like I said to you on the day as well, I very rarely get cast in other people's things, so we know, which is again fairly usual, unless you're an amazing actor. You know, I think I'm. I when I started out, I think I was more interested in acting than being a comedian, you know, but it was very hard to get into acting. And, or, you know, being a funny actor, I'd like to have been in sitcoms and that sort of stuff, and comedy films and things. But I would like to do a bit more. I got an audition that I've signed a non-disclosure thing about, but then it turned out they'd already cast it. But it was like it was sort of, again, like with this film, it's like, you know, it's sort of quite an ego. The last big thing I filmed, I was sort of the romantic lead in, and now I'm the sort of pervy old man who has a grown-up kids. And you're going to go, how did that happen? And you go, oh, yeah, like, A, 15 years have passed, and B, you're old. So it's a film about, with a really cool director, about a band that I'm very interested in and would love to be in. And then but the part I'm playing is someone they encounter who's a sort of fuddy, middle-aged idiot. But I would have loved to have done it. And I actually did loads of work on it the minute I'd signed the non-disclosure thing. And hadn't even got the script, but I did loads of work on it. And then I said, hey, then what's happening with that that film part? They said, oh, yeah, they cast it. They cast it 2 weeks ago. So that was annoying. But I would like, you know.
Who said that? Was that your agent?
Yeah, my agent. My agent sent me the non-disclosure thing, said you have to sign this before you get the script, though. It's like a famous scene that you can watch on TV. So that's why I'd watched it and learnt it all, basically, because I wanted to be, like, bang on. Which, again, I don't... When you do those reads on, like, camera, I find that so irritating that I usually don't put much work into it, but I put loads of work into this one. And I think I would have been good. I think I would have been good at it, but there we go. You never know.
I reckon I've figured out what it is.
Yeah.
Yeah,
hopefully,
yeah.
But I think as long as I don't say who the director is, it's okay anyway. But hopefully the other actor will die, which is, you know, the good thing about being a middle-aged actor is there's the chance that
possibility
over the winter someone might just pass away and you get another chance.
Especially at the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
My agent always says, that's gone away. And you kind of go, oh, right, okay. Well, I have not been cast then. So, no, yeah. That's gone away, Nick.
But, you know, usually I just get on with my own stuff, and I think, like, I don't know whether that's my choice or everyone else's choice. I don't know if people think, oh, he just does his own stuff, so we won't offer him this, but I don't generally get offered much stuff like that, or, you know, many auditions.
I think that was what was sort of really impressive about this film that we did. It's called Giddy Stratosphere, and I don't know when it's going to come out, but it's named after a song. But they kind of, like, just did it. And I've kind of, like, spent, the last 3 years trying to get stuff done through traditional methods of, like, writing treatments and stuff. And I've kind of got to the point where I just want to sort of make stuff.
Yeah.
So it was really interesting being on this set where they kind of, like, made it all happen, especially this year that they made a feature film happen.
No, it's amazing.
So I think...
Maybe that's why they got me on board, because that's the sort of thing I do. You know, I just sort of go, okay, let's try and raise a bit of money and try and get on with and do the stuff ourselves. And I think it's, I'm sort of in two minds about it, because the danger is if you don't have the proper budget, then it doesn't look as good. But also, lots of things that spent loads of money on TV and films are fucking terrible. And some people have spent millions of pounds on them, and you kind of think, just spend some money on getting a decent script and some decent actors. And, you know, if it doesn't look perfect, or if there's mistakes in it in the background, you know, it doesn't matter as long as the thing is good, you know. But I mean, I think they were super professional, these guys. I'm not saying that they weren't professional, but they were super. It was a proper crew and everything. It was great.
Dr. Dolittle cost $175 million.
There you go.
And
so
it was Robert Downey Junior on a screen for 2 hours.
Yes. So, amazing. You know, if they just gave £200,000 to $200,000 to, you know, however many things that would be, a couple of them would be a big enough hit to make some money, I'm sure. So it's such a bizarre industry in that, and it is so frustrating. And, you know, and time passes. That's it. You know, you're 40 or you're 35 thinking, oh, I've still got lots of time, and you've got these ideas, and then suddenly you're 53 going, fuck, you know, I can see the end of the runway here, and it's not, those things aren't going to happen. They're not all going to happen, because they can't possibly happen. So, yeah, so it's nice just to get on with stuff, and that's what, and I think that's what's, and this year, you know, I've been very well placed this year, because obviously I've been just been doing stuff online anyway. And it was, yeah, so we set up all this equipment, like I say, and then we just go, oh, fuck, I can absolutely do nearly everything from home, doing stuff like this from home. You know, this would have been in 2019, you'd invite me on this, it would have taken the whole day for me to come into London. I live in Hertfordshire now. I'd come into London, you know, kick around for a bit, get home again. And so you can do so many things so quickly and so efficiently online. But also, you know, a lot of comedians obviously weren't prepared for what was a very, very sudden loss of absolutely all of their work. Whereas, you know, luckily from my personal point of view, you know, I was able to pretty easily just go, okay, we can just shift this over to being me doing it from home. And so, you know, I've still got a job, but it's, but you know, hopefully this year will make more clubs and more comedians and more creative people realize that they can just sort of get on with quite a lot of the stuff on their own.
How do you feel about going back to outside work? Are you quite comfortable now? Is it like, oh, I'd rather just sit here and not
do I'll certainly go and do some outside work. I'll tell you, I did Taskmaster this year and we recorded all the tasks, but we did the studios at the end of July and it was obviously the first thing out of lockdown, really. And that was just absolutely amazing to go and just, and it was so funny. I just laughed and laughed for 5 days, like tears streaming down my cheeks. And it was so cathartic. It was so wonderful. So I don't think I'd want to be completely shut away here. But it's been nice to spend more time with the family. It's been nice to be absolutely sure that I'm taking an even part in everything, which sometimes if I'm on tour, I kind of feel guilty if I'm away for a few nights that Katie has to deal with more than seems fair. Although last night she had a gig in London. And so, you know, it works both ways. I think to be able to pick and choose a bit more, and to be able to do things from home. And you know, I don't know. I think it's been interesting with this puppet show, which I call a puppet show, but I think it's sort of turning into a bit more of a sketch show. And I think if we spend a bit more in the new year, if we're able to go outside and film sketches, you know, together and spend a bit more time on this, so they're not just green screen Zoom calls. You know, we're basically doing sketches that I write in, you know, in a couple of hours, and then we just do them straight off and maybe do two takes of them, and they sort of go out regardless of how, you know, technically brilliant they are. But it kind of works for what we're doing because they're sort of Zoom call sketches. But yeah, it'd be nice to take that out and do like a bit more and you know, just be in control of your own stuff, I guess. So that I've done a few short films with other people, and you kind of think this is quite nice that you can actually get something that looks really good and just have a 10-minute idea and get it together in a couple of days fairly easily. So I think I'd sort of prefer to do that than a big sitcom that people are coming in and saying, can we change this? Can we do this? Can we, you know, like my Radio 4 sitcom Relativity, which has done pretty well on the radio. You know, my manager was saying, could you do it as a studio sitcom, which with an audience, which is not really what it is, you know, and you kind of go, the minute you take something to TV, you automatically start, you know, you compromise. And then it's just a completely different thing than you want it to be. So I'd rather it was the thing that it is rather than be famous with it and it's not what I wanted to do, you know.
What was your experience like when you were writing Time, Gentlemen, Please?
Oh, man, it was crazy because I was basically writing an American-style sitcom on my own, really. I mean, the first series was 13 episodes initially, and me and Al worked together, and Stu Lee was the script editor and wrote a couple of episodes, but they weren't really right for it. It didn't kind of come out right. And his script editing's always like quite an easy job anyway, I think, unless something's really way off.
What is script editing?
I mean, it's nothing. It's just being another eye and saying, you know, I script edited the third series of Little Britain and literally made no difference to anything. Nothing I said got taken on board. They were up and running and, you know, either if you liked it, you can't congratulate me. If you hated it, you can't blame me. But, you know, I wrote a couple of sketches and they didn't use and I had a couple of suggestions, but they knew what they were doing so much. So, I think if something's new and needs a bit of help guiding in terms of plotting and stuff, then the script editor is... There are some very good script editors, but it can be a job where you can coast by. We were writing together. We wrote a few episodes together and then we sort of started the series. And so Al really wasn't available for the writing. We were quite a long way behind, even in the 13. And then they gave us another 9 halfway through the series. So I was basically writing and it got to the point, I think we had to do 9 shows in 10 weeks, right? So I basically had to write 9 episodes of the sitcom in 10 weeks. So I was just, it was just a production line where I think we recorded on a Thursday. I would bring in the new script on Friday.
As you were filming, so it wasn't like in 10 weeks' time we need 9 scripts, but it was
no,
just like we're filming.
We need a script a week, basically.
That's horrible.
So I mean, but it was sort of insane, and I was going out with one of I was going out with Julie Swallow, who was in the show, and so it was, there was no escaping from the show, and it was very, very intense. But look, I was quite young; I was 30 something and early 30s, and it was really well paid. It was really, and we got proper. Me and Al got proper. It was Sky, and we got proper treatment. And Avalon actually gave us the production fee to share, which they didn't have to do, which was like a huge amount of money that she split between us. So every so when we were doing an episode a week, you know, I bought a brand new car with 1 week's wages, you know, during
fucking hell.
So so because it had taken me a week to write a show, which should have obviously taken me a month. But like in America, you'd have a team of 20 people doing it. But, you know, I had me, yeah. I'd send stuff to Ali, Mike, chip in a joke. I could send it to Stu, who would come back with notes sometimes, but not really. And certainly once we're in this process, there was no real place for the script writer. So they were recording on Thursday. I'd present them the script on Friday, the draft script. Over the weekend, I would rewrite the draft script. On Monday, we'd read it again. I would make changes. And on Tuesday, I would give them the absolute finished script that they would properly rehearse on Tuesday and Wednesday, do it on Thursday. And on Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, I was writing the next week's episode, and so on and so on. But if I'm honest, I don't think those ones were... I think they might have been better than the ones that I spent a month writing. You know, if you have the time, you keep on going over it and changing it. And I'd done enough of them that characters had been established, and it had that kind of... There was a lot of characters, and they all had catchphrases, and they all had ways they would act, and it was kind of... I really enjoyed it, and I was good at that sort of thing, you know, and I don't think anyone else could have done it, but I was... I write in a weird way when I'm writing sitcoms, isn't it? I don't know what's going to happen until it's finished, really, so I'm not... I don't plan it. I kind of start it, have an idea of where it might go, and then see what happens. And then I think the surprises are genuine surprises. But, you know, I was doing the proper interlocking two or three subplots, meeting up, paying off, 24 minutes long, 25 minutes long, it might have been something like that. So they were tricky scripts to write. So it was absolutely overwhelming. And then we did another series the next year, which was 13 episodes. It was less episodes. We did 35 altogether, so it was 13 episodes. And it was easy. It was absolutely, you know, we got it. And a couple of young lads came and wrote a couple of episodes, which I kind of looked over, and they were fine. And, you know, I tinkered with a bit. But basically, we got the character set up and had ideas and had enough time. It wasn't huge amounts of time, but it wasn't 5 days. And so we'd finished that. I'd sort of finished the scripts almost in advance on that one. We kept on tinkering with them. But I like to work with the actors as well. That's why I think, like, I find it difficult to get sitcoms off the ground, because I don't put all my effort into the pilot, you know, into the first draft, because I want to give that to actors, let them dick around, hear it read out, and then make my changes, then work out what needs to be added and what needs to be taken away then, you know. So I kind of don't want to sit down and forensically write something until I've got to that point, you know. And I don't think I could do that now. I find it writing really, really hard now. But I was in a very fecund period. But it completely wiped me out and sort of set me back, really, because I did that for 2 years. Earned a lot of money. Okay, so I did. Oh, you know, it's at the very least you could say that's 6 years' wages in 2 years, but it was 6 years of great wages in 2 years. I had money for the first time in my life, and then bought a house. I sort of sold my flat and bought a house. And although I needed to earn money to pay the mortgage, it was kind of hard to think, you know, I'd worked so hard up to that point with all of the stuff, with the Stuart stuff as well. You know, I'd sort of given up my 20s and half of my 30s and not really gone and done much outside of work. And so it was hard to motivate myself, but also I was kind of burnt out from it as well. So I had a few years where I still did some stuff, I started doing those sort of stand-up shows, but there was a year or so where I was really, sort of 2002, 2003, I would say, you know, I didn't really know where I was going with my life and I sort of was living... I was meant to move into this big house with my girlfriend who had a son, and then we broke up, so I ended up living in a, you know, a family house on my own. And it was quite depressing. And I think I was properly depressed. And I think also just a bit put out that I'd done all this work on... So, you know, in Lee and Herring, I worked much harder than Stu did, so I did a lot of the kind of grafting of of the work of putting together the sketches and doing the additional writing and, ironically, the script editing. And then I'd done this Al Murray thing, and that had been a huge, huge amount of work. And it sort of felt like nothing had really been given any credit, you know, for what I'd done. And so it was very hard to go, why am I going to push myself into doing something else? Which was a shame, because I was in a position where, you know, people were having meetings with me and I was pitching ideas and getting commissions, but then not writing the scripts because I was too burnt out to write them, really. So it was...
You have done that now, right? You have sort of taken control again. So by doing the kind of podcast and things, you're now fully in control of that kind of destiny, right?
Yeah, well, that's what sort of appealed to me about it. Because, you know, when you write something, you're still, you know, if it's going to be good, even though what I said, you know, it's not the finished product when I give it in, you still got to put your heart and soul into it. It still has to work as a script. It's, you know, it's not the same as having children, but they're your babies. And if someone just goes, nah, that's shit, which is what happens, you know, or someone leaves and then you're left and they go, oh, no, the next person doesn't want it. You've worked that hard on it and then it just gets stamped on. The temptation is to just go, well, I won't do it then because I can't face that. But it's, you know, to know there's a very good chance that the thing you love and are working hard on won't ever happen is very difficult to get through. So, yeah, so when the idea of podcasting came along and I had the control to do, just to know it would get made, that was a completely different thing for me. But, you know, but it was sort of me still absenting myself from the industry, I suppose. It was like me saying, I'm just going to go off and do, you know, you're all not really getting what I'm doing. And I was still getting some work, you know, in this time, but nothing that really kind of flew.
So was someone like Sugar your first solo show?
I'd done Christ on a Bike and Talking Cock in 2001, 2002. I think those shows were. So, but I'd sort of seen them as theatre shows, not really stand-up shows. And they were stand-up shows, really, but I just didn't think of myself as a stand-up at that point, and I had a difficult relationship with stand-up. So I'd... you know, I classified them as being one-man shows and didn't give them a stand-up. So, yeah, I came back in about 2004 and started doing the circuit. And then what developed out of that was someone like Jogger, which was a kind of a bit of a fuck you, I'll just do what I want sort of stand-up show, and, like, quite challenging and, you know, long routines. But it was, you know, it was the Daily Telegraph worst comedy experience of 2004 or 2005, whenever it was.
That's crazy. I went to see that in 2004, and I'm pretty sure that was what I was writing theatre and sketches and taking them up to Edinburgh.
Sure.
And we came to see one of your performances, and I'm pretty sure that's one of the ones where I was just like, oh, yeah, this is what I want to do. It was, you had like three 20-minute routines, basically, didn't you?
Yeah, in the hour it was, and then in the tour it was like, it was too long by the tour set show. But the Telegraph guy saw it in Edinburgh, and there was like maybe one or two performances in Edinburgh where it was a struggle. So I think he might have seen one of the bad performances of it. But I was still kind of, it was a point where I was very sensitive because I was coming to stand up and he was saying, you start to question if Richard Herring was ever funny. It was one of those kind of reviews, you know. Yeah. And you kind of think, well, like, it was a year, like, things like Titty Bang Bang had come out. There was some bad stuff, right? So it wasn't even stand-up. It was the worst thing in comedy, according to the Daily Telegraph, which, again, isn't the worst thing that can happen to you, because obviously the Daily Telegraph is a sort of certain reputation. But I think, like, for a comedy critic to come to that and not go, oh, God, I can see that he's doing something, like, at least interesting with the form here.
Even then you say comedy critic, but I think with the kind of broadsheets in Edinburgh, they're not really...
Well, he is, though. It was one of the Dominic guys, Dominic Cavendish. Okay. You know, he is a comedy critic, so he was, you know, he should. I think he just decided to lay the boot. It was a weird thing, because just as I came back to stand-up, which I resisted doing, Stu suddenly exploded as a stand-up. And so, you know, I never really wanted to be, like, the stand-up. I'm glad I got back to it, but it was never like, this is my ambition to be the world's greatest ever stand-up. I just want to do it and experiment with the form of it. But also, because of our shared heritage, we both were doing quite similar things, but he'd had 15 more years experience and broke through basically more or less in that year as his, you know, I think that might have even been the year he had broke through with his big show. And so I was sort of being compared to Stuart as if I had copied him, and I was doing similarly challenging, deliberately dull or deliberately irritating or deliberately repetitive, I think, with a bit more... sort of a bit more kind of scope, I think, than some of the Stew's repetitive stuff, a bit more sort of comedic imagination and taking ideas and running with them. But, you know, that was quite difficult because then we were both, you know, it was hard for me to come back and do that. So I sort of had to then think, how am I going to reinvent myself as something that isn't sort of the Lee and Herring vibe as well?
Yeah. But there's a Venn diagram with you where you're completely different comedians, but there is a crossover point.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It's not really fair to sort of... you're in a double act together, so there's obviously going to be some crossover.
But of course, but then nobody seemed to... You know, it was that... It was just... That seemed to be the vibe. It seemed to be, was Richard ever funny? And, oh, Richard Herring's... Either people knew I'd been the double act and thought I'd copied him, or didn't know I was in the double act and thought I'd copied him, and either, both of which are sort of weird. But,
yes, but,
you know, there was no, has Stuart Lee copied Richard Herring? You know, there was none of that, which was sort of weird. It was weird the way it came out.
But that, Richard, is all bullshit. And it's not something
but I
got
it, you know, it was difficult at the time, but I kind of got over it. I don't care about it, but it made it difficult to come back to stand-up, and that was all the stuff that was happening. And it was weird that a show I was, again, I think probably my most, in terms of selling DVDs, that's the show that sold... which we do through Go Faster Stripe, again, sort of a homemade, you know, not official industry thing, but that was the one that sold the most. So it was a good show. It was an interesting show. When I came, I did them all again, you know, like about 2015, rather than going to Edinburgh, I did all 11 shows and a new show. So I did 12 shows in 6 weekends at the Leicester Square Theatre. And that was the only one that I felt, as a married man and with a kid at that point, I just... The relentlessness of someone like Shoggart in the 2-hour version, I felt, was just too much. It's sort of, I think, a slightly, I had to cut it anyway for time, but if I went, that's one of the only shows I would change if I went back and did it, just because I think there was too much. It was too much relentlessness, and it was too much trying to irritate people. And now, as a parent, you think, this could be what someone's one night out in a month. And I don't want to come just and aggravate people. For
sure, but as a 23-year-old audience member, I still love that show.
Good,
you know, and I still remember that show.
We
had David Baddiel on a couple of weeks ago, and when I watched Mary Whitehouse Experience, that was one of the first series that sort of made me feel like I've got my own taste in comedy.
Sure.
But then when we sort of like grew up watching Fist of Fun and This Morning with Richard, Not Judy, it was you and Stuart that kind of like made me actually want to do comedy.
Sure.
You
know,
it wasn't
That's
just that
nice
I had my own taste. So I think that because you're talking a lot about like your direct experience in your career, but what you maybe don't have like an idea about is kind of like how influential that you've been.
I sort of think I do, but you know, it's still interesting. I think like, but that's the sort of dichotomy with my career is I think within the industry and within comedians, it was, you know, the number of comedians were influenced by either Fist of Fun or my or Stuart's solo shows. Like on my podcast, so many people have gone, the first time I ever saw a stand-up show was you at the Frog and Bucket or you know, wherever. So it's kind of amazing, you know, people, I'm aware that we were very much a comedian sort of show. But also I think it gives a sort of false impression within the industry of our standing in a way. And I think outside of people who were really into comedy, we didn't make that much impact with the double act stuff, I think. So, you know, it's lovely. The people who liked it still love it 25 years on. As I say, I've, you know, resurrected this driving instructor character just for a bit of a laugh because of the moustache. And I saw that, yeah, actually, this is a good character. I might be able to do more with this as we go. So there was very good stuff in there, and I'm very proud of it. I think Stu's less proud of it, but I'm very proud of it.
Of course, and, you have a different perspective on it than everyone else does, don't you?
Yeah, yeah.
You're in it.
It's true, but you know, but I think it was...
is a different...
We were trying to do groundbreaking and interesting stuff, and I think we both have always tried to do that in different sorts of ways. But yeah, so it's great that people liked it, and it's great people. And you know, and how lucky were we to be in that position where we were in our 20s and got our own TV shows? You know, we had 4 series of our own TV shows. I don't think I don't think I fully appreciated how amazing that was. Also, compared to now, there was just no competition. Not the competition there is now to get on TV, and there's so limited opportunities to get anything like that on TV. Stand-ups now.
Well, I was going to say, do you think what you're doing now is also pioneering, right?
Yeah, so well, I think it is.
Now
yeah.
feels like you're doing something where I think, especially for other comics, they kind of look towards you and going, oh, you're doing podcasts, and you seem to, at the start of the pandemic, or maybe it was just before, oh, I'm going on to Twitch. And it feels like almost what you do, others still follow and go, it feels like, what are you doing? That feels like that's right.
Well, you know, I think I've always been, but I think, you know, in a sense, you sort of realise, I think what I would have wanted at the beginning of my career is not what I've got, but what I've got is better than what I would have wanted, I genuinely think. Right. Because I think by not having any massive success, and by but also being successful enough to continually work and make a very nice living and can retain my autonomy throughout, means that I'm still not forced, I'm still want to, but to do interesting stuff. Whereas if you become very successful, A, you haven't got the time to do writing. You're on TV all the time in all the panel shows. And B, you know, you might have other writers. You might have someone saying, oh, don't, you know, if I'd been, you know, David Walliams, to pick a name out there, and in 2010 said, hey, I'm going to have a Hitler moustache for a year and see how that works out for me, I think someone would have probably said, no, you're not. But so as a stand-up, that was a very important show for me and an interesting year for me. And so it's allowed me to do the more esoteric things that, that maybe aren't as mainstream, but also I'm absolutely doing the things that I want to do. So, yeah, I'm not at all complaining. I think I've luckily fallen on my feet. And not through any cleverness or plan, I've ended up with what I would consider to be almost the perfect comedic career, in that I want to be working in 20 years' time, and I want to still be doing stupid stuff in 20 years' time and experimenting in 20 years' time. And you know, that's just the way things have fallen, that's possible for me. And if things had gone the way that I would have loved them to do when I was 22, then I might be happy in a different way. I don't know, but I don't think it would be as interesting as what I'm doing. So yeah, so you know, I'm very happy with the way things are going. And as I say, sure. I've been incredibly. This year has been just. You know, horrible in many, many ways, but in the work terms for me, I've been so fortunate to have all these outlets.
And I think also, like, the goal is to keep working and doing stuff that you personally find interesting.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily... it's good to kind of, like, have that drive and to want to achieve more and to be better and to feel like, oh, I could have done that and I could have done that. But it was also important to remember that every so often, not that it's your driving force, that you're an influencer, but it is important to sort of like every so often reflect a little bit and go, oh, I've actually had sort of like an impact on people's lives. Yeah. Like, I don't know if I'd be doing stand-up if I hadn't been going up to Edinburgh and seeing shows like someone like Sugar.
Sure.
And also, well, you were one of the first people to come and see I Think You Stink 12 years ago.
Yeah.
And you wrote about us in your blog, and I still use that as one of our quotes.
Yeah.
Because we did it again last year in sure. Edinburgh, and it was the first time that we got an audience in 12 years of doing that show. And so you were one of the first people to do it.
But I think staying interested in comedy is really important, you know. So I think a lot of people, I mean, you're getting into that generation, you know, you're getting into the 40s generation, the 50s generation. You see older comics, they either kind of clam up and are annoyed that things have changed, or they embrace the change and love comedy and love what's going on. And, you know, I think I'm obviously very much in that second camp where, especially this year, especially with the rehearsal for this year, I wanted to kind of really highlight newer people who are doing interesting stuff online, you know, more than really famous names. But also I'm interested in watching that stuff. And that show was, you know, that was great. I didn't know you at all. You know, you did a show with Katie, who became my wife very early on. And Katie was a newish stand-up. And, you know, but people in that show, you and Katie and Hannah George, you know, you've all gone on to do really interesting things. But you could see... I didn't know whether you'd be, you know, whether it would be good or be terrible. It's just four kind of newish comedians putting together a show, but it was a really good show. So you can see it. I saw Catherine Ryan, you know, one of those early shows, and no one was going to a show, and I wrote about her. and I thought it was amazing, and everyone else was saying how useless it was, and it wasn't useless, and obviously she wasn't useless. So,
very nice things about a show of mine in 2014, which is very nice on your blog.
Good. Oh, well, you know.
So it's all very positive.
What a great guy I am.
I know.
What a brilliant guy. No, but, you know, I think but it's also...
Yeah, you're sort of a fortune teller.
Well, but, you know...
You put your finger on the pulse.
You can tell what's going to work and what's... I mean, I think I have good comedic sensibility. I think, you know, I sort of... The thing I probably regret is that... that people, when I, you know, when I was in my 30s, people weren't getting me to write loads of scripts for TV because I was able to do it, I was good at it, and I had good and interesting ideas. And I think they were too, they weren't like out there, but I think they were too weird for the people who were commissioning comedy. And I think they would have done really well. And I had the hunger and the ability to sit and write all day, which I don't have now. And I don't really want to massively get into, you know, if I write a series a year of something, then I'm very happy with that. But you know, that's the one thing I think it's a shame that I didn't get the recognition then from the industry, because I think I could have done interesting stuff if I'd been given the budget. But I also think, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now if that had happened. And I think it's, yeah, I would, you know, it's just having a perspective on it and having been through it and made the mistakes and you know, and made some good choices as well. But, you know, it's a very difficult thing to navigate this career. And I think, you know, but my instinct is to be helpful to other people. And I don't think that's a bad thing to do, because it's you know, I don't think it's about, it's obviously there's a competitive element to the business, but I don't think you can waste your time thinking, you know, if I help that person, will that help me or will that hinder me? I think you just have to go, look, that thing is obviously good. You can tell the difference between, I think if you've got a good comedic sensibility, you can tell the difference. Even in something that isn't your taste, you can tell, you know, Michael McIntyre isn't 100% my taste, but when you see him on stage doing stand-up, he's absolutely unbeatable and he's brilliant at what he does. So, you know, I would have predicted, and perhaps not him becoming as successful as he did, but I would have absolutely expected him to become like a big star because he was so good at what he was doing.
I can hear my oven beeping, and it sounds like my gammon is nearly ready.
Oh, no.
So it looks like we're nearly at the end of our Christmas chat, Richard Herring. We've just got... thank you for coming on the show.
No, it's my pleasure. Sorry, I banged on about myself all Christmas. No, ruined Christmas.
I wanted to ask you about when the time that you and Stu appeared on PJ and Duncan shows, the PJ and Duncan show, but we haven't got time for that. So we've only got time for a very quick round of Better or Worse with Nathaniel Metcalf. So I'm going to hand you over to Nathaniel Metcalf.
Okay,
Richard, you have to say that the next person, they're all Christmas themed, is better or worse than the person before.
Okay.
Based on my opinion to score points.
Okay.
Beginning with Noel Gallagher.
Yeah, okay.
Noel Fielding, better or worse than Noel Gallagher?
Better.
Better, he is better. Is Noel Edmonds better or worse than Noel Fielding?
Well, worse.
Worse.
Is Aled Jones better or worse than Noel Edmonds?
I'm going to go for worse.
Better, slightly better. Noddy Holder, better or worse than Anna Jones?
A lot better.
Better.
The Queen, better or worse than Noddy Holder?
Not as good.
Worse.
Yeah, worse. Bing Crosby, better or worse than The Queen?
Better.
Is the Queen Elizabeth or the band The Queen?
The Queen Elizabeth.
Okay. So who was it? Who was it? Who was the choice?
Noddy Holder. Noddy Holder.
Yeah, no, Noddy Holder before. It's after Noddy Holder. Who's coming after
Queen? No, Bing Crosby, sorry. Bing Crosby.
For my taste, worse.
Better. Yeah, David Bowie. Better or
it's
worse?
Not your taste, Richard. It's Nathaniel's taste.
I know, but, you know, I knew...
James Stewart. Better or worse than David Bowie?
Who was it?
James Stewart.
Dave Stewart is worse than... James Stewart. He is better than David Bowie, but you think he's worse.
Worse.
Yeah,
but
I think he's worse.
Oh, yeah, but Nathaniel's a David Bowie fan.
Yeah.
Santa Claus, better or worse than James Stewart?
Better.
I mean better.
Better. Baby Jesus, better or worse than Santa Claus?
I mean he's better. He's the best.
I think he's probably worse, because he hasn't done anything when he's a baby. He hasn't done anything yet.
He has. He could talk.
Okay. So how many did he score? What's the score? What's the score?
I think that's
higher. What's the score? Five! Oh, my God! You scored a five! That means that you're the very worst person that we've had all year at Better or Worse.
Is that right?
You scored a five. He's got a 5, which means that you're not as good as Jen Brister, Thomas Coombs, Jason Manford, Chase Cadeni with 10, David Patel, Ken Cheng, Harry Hill, Luke Morty with 9, Matthew Cosby, Caesar Dent, Charles Heston, Eddie Hearn, David Hepworth, Jason Isaacs, Simon West, Magical Burns, Samantha Morton, Matt O'Kine, Miranda Raisin, Griff Rhys Jones, Chris Stark, Stu Whiffen with 8, James King, Henry Normal, Janet Varney, Johnny Vegas with 7, and Gary Delaney and Frank Harper with 6. But this is amazing, Richard, because everyone always scores 8. And right. No one's a standout. You are the standout.
Thank
by the fact
you very
that
much.
You're the only person with 5. This is incredible. Merry Christmas to you and
Christmas
your family.
Christmas miracle.
Merry Christmas. We've finished the show on a Christmas miracle.
Hooray.
Hope everyone at home is having a lovely, happy time. And if you're not, I hope that you do at some point soon. I've just knocked over my microphone. stay safe. Have a lovely Christmas. And we'll see you in the new year. Thank you for your support all year long. Goodbye.
Bye.
So get dressed and impressed. You win the prize.